Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week.
We may not have an overall recession. We're having a rolling recession. The economy overall looks pretty strong, at least when it comes to jobs.
The financial stories that shape our world.
Three major regional bank failures sent shockwaves through the banking system. We're all trying to figure out what to make of generative AI.
Through the eyes of the most influential voices.
Welcome now, Dr. Paul Krugman.
Brian Moynihan of Bank of America.
Deborah Lehr of the Paulson Institute.
Glenn Hubbard of the Columbia Business School.
Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
The Fed decides not to decide. Reddit goes public, and former President Trump faces foreclosure. This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. This week, Brian Deese on what's really going on with electric vehicles.
I think those headlines would make you more concerned than you should be. The demise of electric vehicles is greatly exaggerated.
And Kristen Roth DeClark of Barclays on a comeback for tech IPOs.
Investor appetite is as strong as it's been in a very long time for IPOs.
But we begin with our very special contributor, Larry Summers of Harvard, as we address what the Fed decided this week, what we heard from Jay Powell, and also maybe a little microeconomics before we're done. So, Larry, thanks for being back with us. Let's start with the Fed, though. What we heard, I heard more growth, less inflation, low unemployment. That sounds pretty good to me. Is it too good to be true?
I don't know. Certainly there's been some encouraging data flow during 2023, though the last 2 months haven't been quite so encouraging. It's great and right to hope for the best, but hoping isn't planning. And certainly from that scenario laid out in the dot plots, I think there's more room for things to surprise on the bad side than to surprise on the better side. We may have the path that's described there materialized. It's certainly got to be recognized as a very real possibility. My sense is still that the Fed is itchy fingers to start cutting rates, and I don't fully get it. We've got unemployment, if anything, below what they think is full capacity. We've got inflation, clearly even in their forecast for the next 2 years, above target. We've got GDP growth rising, if anything, faster than potential. We have financial conditions, the holistic measure of monetary policy, at a very loose level. I don't know why we're in such a hurry to be talking about moving towards the accelerator.
So we heard from Chair Powell that, in fact, he thinks these conditions are restrictive right now. They're decidedly restrictive, even if we're not seeing a lot of restriction. But that depends in part on where the neutral rate is, something we have talked about before. I still don't get a sense from the Fed that they figured out where they think the neutral rate is. And do they need to know that before they can decide where they're going?
They need to take a view, because if you don't know what's neutral, you don't know how expansionary or restrictive you're being. And I find their view that the ultimate neutral rate is 2.6 to be bizarre in current circumstances. Here's what we have relative to a few years ago when they said it was 2.5. We've got fiscal policy in a much, much more expansionary place with much higher deficits, much larger roll of debt. That puts pressure on credit markets. We've got a huge set of new private sector investments going on with respect to green investment in the IRA, going on with respect to resilience and reducing dependence on single sources. We've got a potential huge source of demand for chips and for electricity coming out of the AI revolution. And we've got a huge wealth effect as markets in for both housing and stocks have run way up for the last few years. So with all of those impulses to demand, I cannot understand why someone would form the view that the neutral rate was essentially the same as they thought it was 4 years ago. And I think the neutral rate is far more likely to have a four handle on it right now than it is to have a two handle on it. And from that perspective, I'm not at all sure how restrictive monetary policy really is. And the proof's really in the pudding. Monetary policy's by now had a very long time for the lags to work through. The transmission variables, stock prices, interest rates, long-term interest rates, credit spreads, are flashing green and loose, and the economy keeps surprising on the high side. So either if you look at the fundamental determinants of neutral interest rates, or you look at how fast the economy is growing, seems to me you've got to read a high neutral interest rate, and I just can't understand why the Fed is talking about 2.6 as a best guess. I would be the first to recognize that this is a number that fluctuates, that we can't gauge it precisely, that economists don't have great models. So I'm not saying that I'm sure that they're wrong. I'm not. But I think the challenge in policymaking is to try to make best estimates where you're equally likely to be wrong in both directions.
Larry, it occurs to me that there are policies going beyond monetary policy that could well affect future inflation. I'll mention a couple of them. Trade and tariffs. What are the other factors that might be driving inflation?
Part of the story of the great moderation of low inflation for 40 years has to have been the ways in which globalization held down prices. Flows of capital that promoted productivity-enhancing investment, flows of workers that enhanced labor supply, lower-priced goods that provided competition. The best forms of competition we get in the U.S. economy are often from imported goods. And so if globalization held prices down, it follows that deglobalization will tend to push prices up, which will mean for some interval higher rates of inflation. And I don't think the prospects of tariff increases, of reductions in immigration, of more restriction on foreign investment and what that means for the dollar. I don't think that's reflected in consensus inflation views. And so I think that's another upside risk to inflation. And frankly, it's one that would be substantially exacerbated if the Trump economic program, at least as it's been described in recent months, were to be implemented.
Larry, thank you so much for being with us as always. That's our special contributor, Larry Summers of Harvard.
Higher interest rates have taken momentum away from tech IPOs. But with Reddit up this week and Acera on deck, 2024 may be the year of the comeback for tech companies going public. To take us through it, we welcome back Kristin Roth DeClark, Barclays Global Head of Technology Investment Banking. So welcome. It's great to have you here in person instead of San Francisco.
Yes, great to be here.
So give us a sense. We do have Reddit and Acera right in front of us as we speak this week. But are we seeing perhaps a break in the logjam in tech IPOs?
Investor appetite is as strong as it's been in a very long time for IPOs. Part of that is because there really is a dearth of growth technology assets in the public market that are at scale today. And if you look at all of the public tech companies, over $2 billion market cap, less than 30 have growth rates over 30%. Hmm. So investors are looking for opportunities for growth in the IPO market.
So is there a profile for the companies that are most likely to be successful? Because Reddit's very different from Astera. Those are two very different companies, right?
Well, scale matters to investors. We saw, you know, some of the carnage a little bit from the 2020 and 2021 IPO classes where IPOs were priced at pretty significant premiums to where the, you know, multiples have been on a historical basis and then traded down significantly. The ones that had the, you know, smaller market cap, smaller float were disproportionately impacted. And for that reason, and, you know, the scale really matters in terms of revenue scale. The second piece is, you know, growth rate and the interplay between growth rate and profitability. Mm-hmm. So it's important to have kind of a balance that works. Growth, you get paid more for growth, but that's only if the unit economics work and there is either a break even or a very strong near term path to profitability, you'll get paid more for growth. If the business is not growing, you know, 30% or north of even 20%, then having very significant margins and visibility and durability of those margins.
Has the definition of significant growth changed? I mean, given when you see something like an NVIDIA, some of these growth stocks in tech have just been really, really strong.
Yeah, so I think for an IPO, I would say a growth stock is something north of 20%. 30% plus is really very, you know, differentiated growth rate, but that's how I would think about it today.
What's your sense of the pipeline out there for prospective IPOs in the tech area?
I will tell you, we're tracking over 200 companies that we really think have a credible exit in the public market or entry into the public market, I guess, over the next 2 years. They could also be, you know, sold to strategics or to sponsors, but that's kind of the cohort of the private companies that we're highly focused on for potential IPOs over the next 2 years.
Strictly, you might be looking at two very different revenue models. If you have a consumer-facing products such as Reddit, for example, what the consumer can do, what they can afford, how much they spend could really affect it. On the other hand, if you're over in the artificial intelligence, if I can mention that term area, that's more of a business to business and need for semiconductors and things. Are there two different revenue models here?
Yeah, I'd say that investors right now are anything that's AI and anything that is security related are probably the two areas that have the strongest bid. The consumer facing stuff is a little bit more challenged in terms of a multiple. You're just not getting the same multiple as you get for an enterprise sale that has those two and, you know, kind of end markets. AI, we're just at the beginning of a decade long, you know, shift and change to what we can do from a productivity standpoint. And so we've seen a lot of the stocks that are being, you know, that are really being driven by the advancements in AI trade up significantly. And that will continue, I think. There are going to be fits and starts and play times where investors think, okay, this has been a little bit overbought, take, you know, a little bit of profit taking. But I think by and large, this is a decade long plus shift.
Kristin, really great to have you on, and particularly here in New York. Thank you for coming to New York. That is Kristin Roth DeClark of Barclays. Coming up, we go through the week in the markets with Chris Harvey of Wells Fargo. That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
This is Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. Markets found a lot to like in what the Fed did and said this week as the S&P 500 was up another 2.3% to end at 5234, staying well above the median projection of the Bloomberg L's for a year-end number of only 5100. The NASDAQ added 2.65%, while the yield on the 10-year was down 16 basis points to end the week at 4.2%. To take us through where we are, we welcome back now one of the Bloomberg elves himself, Chris Harvey, Wells Fargo Securities Equity Analyst. Great to have you back, Chris.
Good to be back.
So give us your sense of how the markets interpreted what they heard from Jay Powell this week.
Oh, it was game on. So what they heard was, hey, the macro backdrop is hotter than we expected on a growth and an inflation side, but we're going to keep the same accommodation we had before. So the only thing that's going to change are equity prices, and they're going to move higher. What that was is, to a lot of investors, I need to put on, I'm not going to be penalized for risk, so I'm going to put more risk on. I probably won't be penalized for leverage, so I'm going to put more leverage on. And things got, we had a pretty healthy move, let's just say that. So
one of the things that I find surprising is at the beginning of the year, we expected something like 6 rate cuts this week. We've gone from 6 to 3. Some people think it might be less than that. And yet the equity markets didn't really discount to that. And why is that?
So I agree with that. And that's something we've been talking about. But there's more than one equity market. So higher rates did affect smaller caps, it affected value, and it held those back. But when you look at the S&P 500, the S&P 500 is really a growth index. And growth has just been lackluster. And the fact that you're actually pulling it back to an odd degree actually helps, because you're not accelerating the economy. You're keeping the economy right where it is, which is perfect for growth stocks. And the last thing I would say is that you have this amazing secular growth story in AI that's not going anywhere fast.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to ask about, because it's great we have AI, at least for the moment. We hope it's all going to prove out as brilliantly as people think it is. But is there a risk there in the narrowness of the market, because it's so tied into high tech and AI?
There is a risk to it, right? We don't like to see the market this narrow, but it does make sense, right? When we see a market that's a bit broader, typically we see different things. We see an economy that's moving from contraction to expansion. We're pretty much in this, what I would call, economic malaise, where things aren't great, but they're not terrible. And you should expect a pretty narrow market. And again, the real story here, and I don't want to be too repetitive with it, is this secular growth story that's in play, and the fact that the Fed is adding a significant amount of accommodation to a period or a situation that really doesn't need it.
So you like momentum.
We do. We do.
Quite a bit. Explain that to us. What do you like in this picture that really tells you momentum is the way to go?
So it's not, what do we really like about it? Because the market's so narrow, because there's not a ton of opportunities, everyone's chasing the same names. And so what happens is you get stocks that do well continue to do well. And people say, well, Chris, that's kind of a silly way to invest, and it's kind of naive, and I understand that. But if you look at the fundamentals for the stocks that are doing very well, the fundamentals are actually quite good. And what we keep saying is people are very scared about momentum, because momentum, if you go back to post-financial crisis, say March of 2009, momentum or momentum factors turned on their head, and people lost a lot of money playing momentum. Same thing with the pandemic. But what we're saying right here, right now, a lot of the macro factors that would cause a point of inflection just aren't there, be it credit spreads, be it the economy going from contraction to expansion, or the fact that the contrarian basket or a lot of broken stocks just don't have very good valuations and good fundamentals.
So momentum's good. Tell me about valuation. At what point are they fully valued? And tie that back in, if you would, to earnings. What we're expecting out of earnings is that could take care of the valuation problem.
So, David, what I would say is that we don't have, I talk a lot about valuation, but our clients aren't talking about valuation all that much. And I understand why. We're in a chart looks good, relative growth type market. And so if growth is going higher, you're going to be rewarded by that. At some point, valuation will matter, but because growth is moving so quickly for a select number of stocks, there's really just one game in town, and that will continue for a while. What I think and what you have to worry about with a rotation or broadening out in the market is, will the economy accelerate faster than we expect? And that could cause a rotation, and we just don't see that right now.
One last one. We have another game in town coming up in November. It's called an election. do we take that into account at all as we take a look at investing in the stock market right now?
We do. I don't know how to handicap the presidential election, and luckily I don't have to. The real game in town here is the Senate. Who wins the Senate? And it looks like the GOP has a better than a 50-50 chance at winning the Senate. Why is this important? This is important because this could change the regulatory environment. The M&A market is improving, and if the GOP does take the Senate, we would expect an acceleration of the M&A market later on in the year because of the potential change with regulation.
So you think the antitrust enforcement policy of the Biden administration have held back some M&A? That's part of the reason we've seen a suppression.
Absolutely. There's not a question. It has absolutely held back some M&A.
Last one, taxes, because there's a question we're renewing the Trump's tax cuts. How important is that in the Senate?
It's important, but it's not something a lot of people are talking to us right now. So I think it's more of a 25-26 issue. It's not really a big issue and top of mind for many investors at this point in time.
Fascinating. But you don't want to handicap the election. You sure?
I
we can still do that if you want. You can tell us who's going to win if you want.
I'll just say we'll have a president. We'll have just go and vote. I'm going to vote.
Yeah, there you go.
But I can't handicap.
Well, we'll have a president, which is good news. Thank you so much, Chris, for being back with us. It's Chris Harvey of Wells Fargo. Electric vehicles are a policy priority in the United States, in Europe, and in China, even as automakers, at least in the United States, trim back their ambitious goals. Brian Deese has been at the center of auto policy in the United States, first as a member of the Obama administration team that rescued the industry during the great financial crisis, and then more recently as director of President Biden's National Economic Council, and we welcome him now to Wall Street Week. Brian, welcome. It's good to have you here.
I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, bring us up to speed on electric vehicles, because they were all the rage just a couple of years ago, and now when you read in the press, maybe not quite so much. Maybe the consumers are not rushing to buy them. You see some U.S. automakers cutting back on their goals. What's going on?
Well, I think those headlines would make you more concerned than you should be. The demise of electric vehicles is greatly exaggerated. And so let's start with the numbers. So in 2023, there were about 1.4 million electric vehicles sold in the United States. That was almost 10% of overall sales. That was up 50% from a year before, so really significant growth. First couple of months of this year, EV sales are up about 20%, 15 to 20%. So the rate of growth is slowing, but I think that that's actually reasonably what you would expect. This is a market that, as it matures and as it becomes a larger share of overall vehicle sales, expecting year-on-year 50% growth rates was never realistic. And so I think the question is, where will this growth trajectory lead out? And also, when will the appetite for those electric vehicles butt up against consumer concerns and consumer adoption? I don't think we're there yet. And so, you know, a rate of growth that's 20% year over year would be pretty good for a lot of industries. But we're certainly seeing a slowing compared to the rate of pickup in 2022 and 2023, which was really quite extraordinary.
Overall, the demand for EVs in the United States continues to go up, even if more slowly. But different makers are taking different approaches to stimulating that demand.
Ford, for example, cut prices significantly on the Mustang Mach-E as a response to demand. All eyes will be on Tesla, of course, because Tesla is the market incumbent, the pure play EV name. How it fares in the first quarter will be critically important. You know, there is something happening where the early adopters in America have been and gone in terms of the consumer, and there is still an assessment to be done on how impactful the incentives provided by the Inflation Reduction Act are going to be.
And it's not just the traditional big three U.S. automakers seeking to take advantage of those incentives, raising the specter of the U.S. being left behind by overseas producers the way we saw in the 1970s.
I think there's a risk. I think you listen to what the leadership of Ford and GM and Stellantis as well are saying. They recognize they're behind, that this is fundamentally a technology play. Electric vehicles, it's a fundamental shift in technology. It's not just an incremental shift in vehicle technology. And they were behind. Tesla, Hyundai, Kia are both ahead. That said, I think you're seeing, certainly GM and Ford both invest a lot in saying we need to catch up, and we need to catch up quickly. I would say Ford's CEO, Jim Farley, has been very blunt about this in saying we're going to need to remake this company. We're going to need to do things differently in terms of how we organize ourselves to drive innovation, to actually catch up and catch up quickly in a growing global market as well. So I am hopeful that what we'll see is that kind of commitment actually manifests in the marketplace, and we've certainly seen some. We're seeing those companies increase their sales sequentially as well. But I think that's always a risk, right? We're going to have to stay ahead, and it's a dynamic global market.
Is there a challenge in the price point? Because certainly GM, for example, started out with the more expensive vehicles, made sense because they needed to cover the cost. At the same time, again, going back to my recollection of when Japan really made inroads, yeah, they started out pretty inexpensively. You have some less expensive models coming from overseas.
Yeah. Look, there's different approaches to this electric vehicle market that are really fascinating, where I think that the dominant approach is to start at the very high price point, try to capture that margin, and then drive prices down across the board. I would argue that actually, learning from history, there's a real opportunity to own the lower cost segment of this market, right? To be the electric vehicle provider for typical middle class folks across the country. We've seen some innovation on that front. GM introduced the Chevy Bolt, and for part of last year, it was the fastest growing electric vehicle in the country. And so I think it's possible. And the other thing that's good news for consumers is, in addition to seeing this electric vehicle growth, prices are coming down very significantly. We've seen a 20% reduction in the cost, the purchase price of electric vehicles, just over the course of the last several months. That presents a constructive challenge to the auto companies, but it's good news for consumers that we're seeing more and more of these vehicles get into a price point, which is really, in many ways, you know, comparable, particularly when you take into account the overall cost of ownership.
Finally, talk us about the labor consequences of electric vehicles. As I understand it, it takes significantly fewer workers to produce an electric vehicle than an internal combustion engine car. What does this mean for the auto worker, which is very much on everyone's mind right now?
Well, look, I think what you need to look at is the entire value chain. And so the electric vehicle itself, from an assembly perspective, has fewer parts and therefore less labor. The building of the batteries and the whole upstream supply chain there creates new opportunity, and new opportunity for workers and for labor. So that whole battery supply chain that I was just talking about, it's referred now, you know, often as the battery belt, you know, from Michigan down to Georgia. We're seeing this investment in the manufacturing and the processing and these upstream components as well. Taken together, that creates real new opportunities for American workers, American labor. I think it's one of the reasons why these things aren't easy, but you've seen even the UAW come around and recognize that this is the future of the industry, and the opportunity is to effectively organize that whole value chain. And they're seeing more opportunity than threat from that.
I'm happy to say that Brian Deese is going to be staying with us as we turn to what this fall's presidential election could mean for the U.S. economy. That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you're here as in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
This is Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. Former National Economic Council Director Brian Deese has stayed with us to talk about the economy. So, Brian, we've got an election coming up. You may not have noticed it coming in November. And it looks like it's going to be Joe Biden versus Donald Trump once again. Give us your sense, having been in the White House. What difference does it make? Because it occurs to me sometimes I think we put too much pressure on the president and the White House. They can't control everything in the economy. How much of a difference does it really make?
Well, look, I don't know if this election is going to be decided on policy and policy differences, but it should be. Because if you look at the difference between these two candidates, the differences are as stark as any, certainly any election in modern history. We've got President Biden's got a basic approach to the economy that he has laid out, and now you can see. We're talking about significant investment in industrial renewal in the United States, a commitment to the idea that public investment in things like infrastructure, things like clean energy, a build out of the semiconductor industry will help to expand productive capacity, ultimately expand real wage growth. And that's his strategy. And then, frankly, it's consistent with who he is and how he's approached the economy for some time. Candidate Trump, on the other hand, is a dramatic departure. And the thing that I think we're probably paying insufficient attention to is at a moment where prices are the top issue on Americans' minds, and we've finally seen real progress in bringing inflation down and bringing prices down, the basic Trump approach of protectionism across the board, indiscriminate tariffs, shutting down immigration, and raising costs like healthcare costs by getting rid of pharmaceutical regulations, getting rid of the Affordable Care Act, is a recipe for significant inflationary pressures in the economy and price increases for typical families. So, you know, I think that that's a real short-term effect and a real difference between these two candidates.
So let's talk about a couple of those, if we could. And they are immigration and they are protectionism, as you put it, on trade. President Biden has not really dialed back substantially on the tariffs put in place under President Trump, as I recall. And certainly when it comes to China, it doesn't sound like they have a very different position. Is there really a difference when it comes to trade between these two men?
I think there is. I think it's pretty stark. President Biden has had a basic two-part approach when it comes to trade, which is one, have a very targeted approach to protecting American interests, economic and national security, when it's warranted. And two, really committing to work with partners and allies to try to build more capability and effectiveness when that is the case. So if you look at something like semiconductors, the Trump administration really didn't take any action when we were looking at sensitive dual-use technology that were potentially getting in the hands of the Chinese or other adversaries. The Biden administration came in, President Biden came in and said, I am going to put a stop to that, but I'm going to work with my allies and partners to do so because otherwise it's fundamentally ineffective. You Contrast that with the Trump approach, which it's still emerging, so we'll have to see what happens on the campaign. But if it does turn out that what we're talking about is a 10% across-the-board tariff on all products coming into the United States from allied countries, from countries or from products where we don't produce anything here in the United States, a cup of coffee, that is a very extreme and new step. You talk about completely eliminating permanent no more trade relationships with China. Candidate Trump has said at times, I want to literally eliminate all imports from China, period, end stop. The macroeconomic impact of those steps would be significant, you know, potentially a couple of points off of GDP. And the practical impact on those for families would be quite significant too. People would start to see it. And I think that general Trump approach is one of core isolationism, which is not only to erect those barriers, but basically to alienate our allies in the process. That creates, you know, potentially larger risks across the board. So I think that the top line, well, you know, there's not that much difference in them on trade, is a complicated position when you unpack it.
And what about immigration? There was a time there seemed to be a very big difference between them. Former President Trump certainly would say there's a big difference, but it feels like President Biden has moved toward the position of President Trump. Is there a big difference at this point? Isn't any president going to have to address that southern border no matter what?
100%. The border will need to be addressed, and it'll need to be addressed in an appropriate and aggressive way. I think the big difference in what I worry about is with respect to the legal immigration system. So one of the significant things we've seen over the past couple of years, the reason why we've seen significant increases in labor supply and labor force participation, it's legal immigration has come back after COVID and after the Trump administration, as well as more women coming into the workforce. That process of legal immigration that is now normalized, and the Biden administration prioritized, for example, working down visa backlogs and trying to get to a more normal system. I think under a Trump administration, you could expect that to revert. And I think in addition to that being bad for innovation and bad for broader economic growth, it could also be quite inflationary in the short term, because what you're doing is constricting labor supply at a moment where we need more workers in the United States. Our legal immigration system has been an engine for growth for decades, for a long time. I think that there would be a big difference on that front, because I think you're right. With respect to the southern border, it will need to be addressed. It'll need to be addressed in a realistic but aggressive way.
What about fiscal policy? I mean, as you said, President Biden has really pursued a policy of investment, which is amounted to fiscal stimulus as a practical matter. There's a fair amount that's still to be expressed. It hasn't come through the system yet. Is there a big difference in addressing the deficit and the debt? Because a lot of people, at least on Wall Street, are pretty concerned about it at this point.
Yeah. Well, and I think there's reason for concern. The biggest difference here is with respect to tax policy. And there, the numbers are very large. So if you look at, there was a recent analysis of what would it look like for Trump policy to go into effect, if you're talking about both extending the Trump tax cuts that were put in place in 2017, many of which expire in 2025. And then you add on to that things that Trump has been talking about to include a reduction in the corporate tax rate to 15%. All told, that would be about $4.6 trillion in additional tax cuts over a decade. That's almost 2 percentage points of GDP. It would take our revenue down below 15% of GDP. Very different from what a President Biden is talking about, where he's talking about actually trying to increase taxes, raise that corporate tax rate back up from 21, closer to 28%, increase taxes on the very wealthy by a significant amount. That could raise a couple of trillion dollars. So that gap between the two is well over $5 trillion. That will be a line of debate and a line of demarcation in 2025. But given the fiscal backdrop we have, I think if the market actually internalizes the idea that we're not going to do anything about the Trump tax cut extension, and in fact, we're going to come and we're going to layer on that with additional tax cuts, then I think that will, you'll start to see that in impact on long-term borrowing costs, because it will send a signal that we don't really have any serious plan to address the revenue shortfalls we have in this country.
Brian, thank you so much for being on Wall Street. Really good to have you here. That is former National Economic Council Director Brian Deese. Socrates said, my friend, care for your psyche. Know thyself, for once we know ourselves, we may learn how to care for ourselves. And let's face it, just about all of us could take better care of ourselves, like getting enough sleep and reducing stress.
We see that these five daily behaviors of sleep, food, movement, stress, and connection dramatically affect our health and our longevity.
People who've run big companies like Indra Nooyi of Pepsi see a greater need than ever to care for the psyches of their employees.
I think post-pandemic, we are seeing more and more people say, I have to worry about me as a person. I have to worry about my family. I want to worry about my well-being, my mental health. So we've got to start encompassing people as holistic humans as opposed to a tool of the trade.
Some of us turn to psychotherapists, as mob boss Tony Soprano did.
Any thoughts at all on why you blacked out?
I don't know. Stress, maybe.
But for some, it's not enough to get more sleep or have a more thoughtful boss or have someone to talk to. Some of us turn to chemistry, like Elon Musk, who is talking about his use of ketamine again.
There are times when I have a negative chemical state in my brain, like depression, I guess, you know, is depression that's not linked to any negative views. And then ketamine is helpful for getting one out of a negative frame of mind.
And now there's a new game in town, or really an old game that some of us may remember, perhaps hazily, from the 1960s. Yes, there's a return to magic mushrooms. Mike Tyson does it, even when he was partying in St. Bart's with Jake Paul, the man he's due to fight this July.
Are you taking shrooms before the workout just because you like the space of thinking that comes with
absolutely.
It?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
The focusness of shrooms, it can't compare to nothing else.
Okay.
Chelsea Handler does it with her employees.
You took them camping and everyone took mushrooms?
I didn't provide the mushrooms, just for legal reasons. I want to be stated very clearly.
Where in the budget is that? Is that craft service?
People can pick mushrooms in the forest.
Bloomberg this week reported on so-called magic mushrooms being touted by executive coaches. And the Wall Street Journal had a piece on these magic mushrooms being, quote, the working woman's newest life hack. Steve Cohen has doubled down on his investment in Cybin. That's a biopharmaceutical firm in clinical trials for a medicine to handle serious depression. A medicine that uses, you guessed it, the active element found in magic mushrooms. Given all the buzz, maybe this really is the way to go. But as my wife could tell you, I'm pretty conservative. And back in the 90s, when I was general counsel of Cap Cities ABC, we had a big commitment to the Partnership for a Drug-Free America. That's a charity founded by J&J CEO Jim Burke, who just happened to be the brother of my boss, Dan Burke. And the PSAs we ran on ABC had a decidedly different approach to psychedelics.
This is your brain. This is drugs. This is your brain on drugs.
That does it for this episode of Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. This is Bloomberg. See you next week.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.